This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mamie Rosenberg. Are workers being forced to lose their health and or their lives in America just to stay employed? We decided to put that question to Marcy Goldstein-Gelb, co-executive director of the National Committee for Occupational Safety and Health, a national leader in the fight for safe, healthy working conditions, and to ensure that all workers can earn their living with dignity and respect and return home alive and well at the end of their shift, and particularly while the coronavirus is on the prowl. Marcy, I just think a few worker categories come to mind for me. Postal workers and grocery workers and sanitation workers and EMTs and building maintenance and daycare providers and welfare workers. And there's so many different groups of workers, but the question really is now. And as we look at additional groups of people, such as teachers with schools being opened, your concern as somebody who deals with occupational safety and health, what's at stake for the working class now? Is there any real consideration from a federal administration or its agencies as to the health situation in the midst of COVID to these groups of workers and so many more?
I would have thought that with all the people losing loved ones, with so many, that extent and the spread of death has hit so many that I would have thought that there would have been leadership that would have stood up and said, we need to turn the tide, we're going to make a change. Workers have been abandoned. The public has been abandoned, worse than abandoned. Workers have been pretty much told, keep your mouth shut, go to work, and being marched to their deaths, to illness, to death, to deaths in their communities. What really has happened is that workers and labor organizations, worker centers, cash groups are coming together, and workers have to take action on their own behalf because there's nobody looking out for them. The government agencies that exist to protect the public, worker health and safety, have abandoned their roles. It's put the public, put workers in a position where they're forced to be the only ones. Now, I've always been a believer that workers should have the power to speak up and that they play the most critical role in protecting the health and well-being of themselves and their workplaces. And that it's critical for workers to be able to speak up freely, and we could talk about anti-retaliation protections and some of the issues recently, but that's always been the top priority. When workers speak up, when they identify dangers, that's when action needs to be taken, and without that, you don't have the eyes and the ears. So it's understandable that workers would be taking actions into their hands, but being abandoned by our government, by those that exist to protect workers and the public is just an abomination.
Isn't it more than just being abandoned? It's almost like giving license to it. I mean, Trump administration has basically said in case of meatpacking that there's very limited liability on the part of the employers. CDC just offered new guidelines with regard to, under the pressure of the Trump administration, loosening controls in hospitals. Trump's administration's proposed legislation with regard to liability nationwide of the employers. I mean, it's almost as if they're saying the workers would be go to work and face death or else quit.
That's exactly why earlier I said they're being marched to their death. That's exactly what's happening.
What are some of the main areas that feel the most exposure? Mimi mentioned quite a few. What's your top picks?
Anyone who is working out in where they're exposed to coworkers, tight quarters, with indoors in particular, is at grave risk. But if I were to pick sort of an example, of course, meatpacking, slaughterhouses, seafood processing, those that prepare our foods are being slaughtered in incredible numbers. Fairly recent numbers are over 6,000 workers in meatpacking alone. And those were ones that were counted by the union, so that's just unionized workers. And at least 86 deaths counted by the Center for Disease Control, which they certainly are. I wouldn't be surprised if that's an undercount as well. And who are we talking about? We're talking about people of color and immigrants working shoulder to shoulder on the line, cutting up, skinning, and packing chicken parts, you know, rapid hand motion, just the line speed, which just makes everything that much worse. It's just devastating what entire communities have been put through. And local health officials have cried out and tried to take action as well. Internally, you know, there was some email exchanges that became public about just the dire expectations of what people are seeing, and the response of the meat packing companies were, you know, we need our meat. That's one example. Certainly warehousing, we could go to that, but I could stop at meat packing if you want for the moment.
Sure.
Go ahead with warehousing.
Warehouses, you've got workers who, again, are risk knowing that they, and shouldn't be, risking their livelihood by speaking up about poor conditions, about working in close proximity, the lack of sufficient cleaning products, lack of social distancing, being retaliated against, being fired. There's a group of workers who sued Amazon after they fell ill and a family member died as a result of being exposed by someone who worked at an Amazon warehouse. Amazon, you could afford to make sure that customers get their products within a day or two, but you can't afford to ensure that your workers can be free from death and illness. It's really outrageous. So warehouses are certainly another area where we're expecting our products quickly, and big corporations making billions of dollars are saying that workers can't speak up about hazards.
Marcy, is there any sense about the severity of the contagion, thinking about farm workers and agricultural workers, et cetera? Do we have a sense of what has been happening to them? I think there's a tendency to think that because there's largely outdoor work, that the distancing may protect them more from being subject to COVID. But I don't believe that. Do you have any information?
We have heard from a number of farm worker advocacy organizations. A lot of folks are living in cramped quarters, and they do need to have person-to-person interaction. So despite being outdoors, there are other risks that they face, still continuing to work long hours without access to the sort of testing and all the things that they need to be safe. And there's just enormous fear, and so that is certainly happening, even those that are working outdoors.
And I understand there's also problems even in the hospitals. The National Nurses United is complaining about lack of protective gear and many other things. So should you comment on that?
I'm going to share my own personal experience. I unfortunately had to go to the hospital after contracting COVID myself and had chest pain. I had wonderful support from the staff there. There was someone who came in to clean my room. There was a nurse who came in to take care of me, and there was a doctor. Nurse came in. She had a KN95, which is a fairly protective equipment, though we don't know the extent to which it had been fitted, et cetera. However, the person who came to clean my room had just a surgical mask, and this was in the COVID ward. Even the doctor who came in had a surgical mask and then one of those plastic shields. Plastic shield is great if he's concerned about me sort of spitting at him or directly coughing at him, but it's not going to help for the airdrops might be around the room. So I found that to be the case throughout the floor, that there were people who were just wearing surgical masks or sort of haphazard getting whatever they could. That's not the way that our healthcare system should be. We should not be having all of these levels of healthcare providers working in a COVID ward, saving our lives without the protective gear that they absolutely deserve. Had we invoked the Defense Production Act right at the get-go and made sure that we had sufficient quantities and we put together a whole system of ensuring that there's fit testing and that people had made sure that they had the protective gear, we would have saved so many lives. There's been so many illnesses and deaths in healthcare. It's just outrageous.
The mission of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, known as OSHA, is to protect workers. But it's clear that many healthcare workers and factory workers and transit workers and others have said that they don't feel protected during this pandemic. So there, as I understand it, have been thousands of complaints to OSHA about unsafe working conditions due to COVID-19. But OSHA has not even inspected a single workplace. Can you talk about what you know of what OSHA has and hasn't been doing and how it has? Well, Ken suggested that it's not even a matter of negligence or inadvertence, but absolutely give license to employers to continue to see people, workers, as cannon fodder for their own industry or certainly expendable. What has OSHA not been doing?
It is worse than just simply abandoning workers, because when workers take that step and file a complaint, which thousands have, they are putting themselves at grave risk of retaliation. And so for an agency to fail to investigate, to fail to back them up and to do what they're supposed to do with their own tools to take action to protect the well-being of workers, it's worse than a failure. It's really negligence. On a good day, if OSHA had enough horsepower to ensure employer compliance, then workers would still be playing the most essential role. They're the eyes and the ears of potential dangers. But now we have the perfect storm. We have OSHA understaffed and negligent in its responsibilities. We have whistleblower protections that are already ineffective. Every day, workers are walking into potentially life-threatening conditions, being forced to choose between their health and those of their coworkers and families. So this is really just putting workers in the worst possible situation, and one that spreads the entire workplace and family.
Tell us what you know about the administration of OSHA. The last time I looked, there were more than 18,000 complaints with state OSHAs, and they had already closed 12,000 complaints from terrified workers, and there was not a single fine imposed, a single punitive action, nothing. Who is running OSHA, and what should we understand about their politics, which would help explain why this agency, whether it's the state or federal OSHAs, are doing nothing for workers threatened by COVID?
OSHA currently is being led by an interim. There has not been a permanent OSHA leader appointed. We have not had a permanent head of OSHA. That alone is indicative of the importance that OSHA has been seen within this administration. Since 2014, there's been nearly a 10% increase in fatalities in the workplace, just over that four-year period. And the fatalities are rising faster for workers of color. It's 20% increase for that same period for Latinx workers and nearly 30% increase for African-American workers. Workplace inspections have dropped by about 10.5% between that period. And inspectors, you know, back in 1979, there were 1,441 inspectors. In 2020, there's 875 inspectors to cover 9 million workplaces. It would take well over 100 and some odd years to have OSHA inspect every workplace. So we've seen OSHA decimated. We've also seen that OSHA has completely played not only a non-role, but a harmful role, because workers are speaking up and expecting to be protected, putting themselves at risk, and had worse than nothing happen. And in many cases, OSHA will send a fax over, which effectively sends a message, you know, well, we have these guidelines, so you might want to think about following them, but if you don't, you know, don't worry about it. Only in the last few months, there was two or three citations at a nursing home, and that's pretty much the extent of it.
It seems it's more than benign and neglect. It almost seems to be a case of deliberacy, and particularly when you're looking at the rampant speed in meatpacking and poultry plants or in nursing homes, where there were at least like 30,000 cases that we know about in meatpacking and 35,000 in nursing home workers where people were sick, and nothing was done.
You know, you have the same that the recent Office of the Inspector General report really put a spotlight on what is really, you know, widely known by many of us, which is that one of our most important protections, which is anti-retaliation protection, is not only failing to protect, but again, by filing a complaint, puts a worker further at risk of retaliation. So, you know, there's been countless instances of workers who have taken that risk of filing for an OSHA complaint only to find that it's dismissed, it's disregarded, closed because it's more than the 30-day period, and every day that goes by when a worker has spoken up about a hazard, that the message is that they're going to be subject to retaliation, it simply silences all workers, and it means that hazards go unaddressed.
The Center for Disease Control has some certain standards, which they are now relaxing at the behest of the Trump administration. Even with that, is there any kind of enforcement of that possible, either by OSHA or other groups? And if not, where do workers turn? I mean, unions have filed grievances, but that takes time, and that's always not effective. I know the United Food and Commercial Workers have been meatpacking. So what is to be done?
What's to be done is taking to the streets. That's exactly the only thing that's been effective, is workers coming together collectively with unions, worker centers, cost groups, putting old-fashioned pressure on employers to do the right thing and demanding that workplaces address these hazards. That's what, you know, the National Nurses Union got, workers who are not unionized, who are taking collective action, organizing strikes, organizing slowdowns. That's all well and good, and that's what's needed. It should be backed by the right to sue. So the AFL tried to sue the Trump administration. Meatpacking workers in Missouri with public justice tried to sue the meatpacking industry. So there needs to be more tools so that workers can be able to defend their right to safe working conditions. And it comes at every level. It comes at workers taking action, local authorities having the tools to take action, the right to be able to use the courts if need be, and then, of course, our federal agencies doing their job. So all of these should be happening in concert. And when they fail to happen, all you have is people taking action collectively, because that's the only thing that can't be taken away. You know, obviously you can in terms of firing people, but with allies, that's all you have.
Marcy Goldstein-Gill, you're the co-executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, and are still in the process of recovering yourself from COVID-19. So I wonder, you explained a little bit before about how actually that affected you, but I'm wondering politically how having contracted this terrifying contagion at a time when there continue to be denialists for the most opportunistic purposes to see the reelection of a current Republican administration from the Senate levels through the presidency. How does your bout with COVID really inform the kind of work that you do, and also perhaps further dramatize how terrifyingly this society treats workers when it comes to health and safety? Clearly they have decided that we are expendable.
I have the luxury of being able to quarantine at home and continue to work and earn a living. And I have the ability to know that I would not lose my job for if I needed to get medical treatment. I had health insurance. So all of the things that should never be a luxury were basic and available to me. The other thing is it just, my being a part of this process, made it so patently clear how wrongheaded and fraudulent these policies are. The fact that to have back early on the policy that if you're exposed, you don't need to quarantine. And now most recently, if you're asymptomatic, you don't need to be tested. Now, I was asymptomatic. I got tested because I had traveled somewhere and just wanted to be safe. I was asymptomatic for 4 days. And then I started having severe breathing problems. I know firsthand, and I've read that and heard that from many, 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 many others. That's the pattern. And that you can transmit the disease while you're asymptomatic, that also it's not over even when you're no longer infectious, that I continue to have health problems. Seeing this firsthand, I've always, you know, this has always been something that I've been passionate about since I became involved with worker health and safety. But there is this difference being a part of it and knowing both that I should not have this luxury that others don't have, but also seeing just how horrible it is to be ignoring basic science for politics is just an abomination.
Marcy, you told us to keep boots on the ground. Absolutely. As we project towards another administration, though, is there particular legislation or things that should be happening to assure that there are more mechanisms to deal with the retaliation and the actual working conditions that people are forced to work and very often die under? And of course, it's not just COVID that we're talking about. There are untold numbers. As a matter of fact, you could probably put some numbers onto what happens to workers in the course of their employment. So what is there to do on the federal level that would also protect workers?
If you don't mind, I'd like to start with well before the election and then move to federal, because right now, you know, National COSH and our network, the Protecting Workers Alliance, released a Safe and Just Return to Work in June, which has a number of measures that could be enacted at the local and state level without for a change at the federal level. So more and more people, workers, organizations are putting pressure on states to enact, first of all, stronger anti-retaliation protections. We've had our Philippash in Philadelphia. They've worked with a coalition and gotten local legislation passed. And there's groups around the country that are working on this in Massachusetts. There's a new effort at the state level to ensure stronger anti-retaliation protections, because it's recognized how absolutely critical it is for workers to be able to identify potential hazards and how that affects the public. Relatedly, there's also a lot more effort being pushed by our network to have workers have a strong voice and be sort of the eyes and the ears. There's new worker health and safety councils being developed. There was one in LA County. There's another in Massachusetts. So that's another critical place where workers and labor organizations can be at the table, monitoring, participating in enforcement. So there's a number of measures at the state level, including establishing emergency standards for infectious disease control. Obviously, there's Virginia that just passed. There's work in Oregon that's already making great progress. And so this is being moved around the country as well. So even well before the election, there's a lot that can be done to strengthen, in addition to obviously collective action. At the federal level, there's so much that could be done and must be done moving forward. First and foremost is always making it possible for workers to organize collectively and to pursue actions in multiple levels. So making it easier to organize for a union, strengthening anti-retaliation protections, dramatically improving the OSHA, it's called 11C, and anything that strengthens workers' voice is going to save lives. Then, of course, there's the emergency temporary standard, which should be enacted immediately, doesn't even require legislation, and requiring that employers create infectious disease prevention, and why not broaden it to other exposures, but first and foremost, infectious disease prevention, with workers having a strong voice at the table. So that's just the beginning. There are many measures that are needed to really protect both workers, their families, and the public.
Marcy, we really want to thank you very much for these analysis of what's going on now and what we can be doing in the short term and in the longer term to protect the workers and the public from not only coronavirus, but other work and safety issues. Is there anything that's on your mind that we haven't covered that you'd want to bring out at this point?
With every travesty, there's an opportunity. And this has been an absolute devastating travesty. People losing their lives and people losing their livelihoods and just abject poverty. I don't think we've had anything like this in hundreds of years. But with that does come a very, very deep opportunity. Having worker organizations and labor and community groups come together and really envision a new voice for workers, and not letting people forget that workers will always have always been essential, and that if they are going to be essential, they need to be respected, and having a strong voice in every aspect of civic life and work life. So that's really the takeaway for me, is that we can't let people forget. Don't just call workers essential. Mean it and do something about it.
Well, Marcy, please, please continue to heal well. And for all of your commitment to workers, we are indebted. And we have been speaking with Marcy Goldstein-Gelb, co-executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. And again, we insist that you stay strong, stay well, heal well.
Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you and really appreciate the work that you do to shed a spotlight on these really critical issues. So thanks for calling. Bye-bye.
I'm Mimi Rosenberg with Ken Nash, and you've been listening to Building Bridges. Stay strong, stay well.